temperature wind northwest at 6, wind chill minus 3. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm excited that we can begin the program today with Justin Spiesman, who is both an attorney and also a best-selling author, who in particular has written some very compelling books from the world of sports. And his most recent is called Coach, The Greatest Teachers in Sports and Their Lessons for Us All. It is Justin Spiesman's contention, and I think a lot of people would agree with him, that all great coaches are teachers first, and that coaches have a lot to teach all of us, even those of us who do very little, if anything, out on the athletic field. Or another way to say it is the wisdom of coaches is wisdom that should not be confined just to the playing field or arena or tennis court or wherever. But there are many lessons that can be applicable to the rest of life. And as I said, Justin Spiesman has written a number of important books. Among them, Don't Give Up, Don't Ever Give Up, about basketball legend Jim Valvano, The Business of the Best, Inside the World of Go-Getters and Game Changers, and Take Your Team to the Top. Again, this latest book is titled Coach, The Greatest Teachers in Sports and Their Lessons for Us All, published by Half Full. Justin Spiesman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. That was a wonderful introduction. Yeah. I think you described the essence of the book very well, that these lessons and these coaches are so easily transferable to every walk of life. Whether it be business or whether it be parenting, whether it be just about every interaction we have. I mean, we have so many wonderful lessons from the, you know, from the bounds of the sports field that we can carry through the other parts of our life.
Briefly, I wonder if you could just tell us about your own love of sports, kind of where that started. Did it start with you yourself being an athlete? And at what point did you start to think about sports and the world of athletics kind of beyond its kind of normal confines?
Growing up, I was an athlete. I still, you know, struggle through. I'm in my 40s, but I struggle through pickup basketball. It hurts a lot more than it once did, but I grew up playing every sport I could play, and then eventually kind of focused on soccer, and was a pretty decent soccer player back years ago. And so I've always loved sports, and I think, you know, I've always kind of learned through athletics. Some of my greatest teachers were coaches, and my dearest friends in life are friends that I met, you know, on the basketball court or the soccer field or the baseball diamond. And so even so, growing up, you know, being from Atlanta, I grew up in a time where we had some excitement in the city. I mean, the Atlanta Braves, which are now once again a very exciting team, but we had Bobby Cox and a really remarkable run in the National League in the 90s, which was really fun to be a part of. We got a World Series out of that and a bunch of National League titles and won in at least a whole bunch. And then I grew up with Dominique Wilkins. The human highlight film is kind of the backbone of the Atlanta Hawks, which was really cool to have a Hall of Famer involved in the franchise like that. And even the Falcons were pretty decent. You know, 98, we went to the Super Bowl, and that was a fun run with the Dirty Birds. So I grew up at a time where Atlanta sports, which is what I grew up and loved, were actually pretty strong. And now we're seeing, in this year, the year of the coach, we're seeing Georgia sports making a pretty substantial comeback with the Bulldogs winning the title and the Atlanta Braves weren't in nationally, or I'm sorry, a championship. So it's kind of come full circle. And I just, my fondest memories in life with friends, with family, always seem to coincide with a sport moment. And so it's just always something that's carried me and something I've loved to talk about and write about. And so when I was approached to do a project like this, it immediately resonated with me. And I knew I was going to take on a lot. I mean, there's 170 coaches in this book from all walks of sport, male, female, high school, college, professional, team sports, individual sports, Olympic sports. It really does. It's almost a study, a compilation of just the greatest sport, its greatest coaches in the history of sport. So I knew I was taking on a lot, but it was just a remarkably intriguing and fun journey from the stories we all know. The Nick Sabans, the Bill Belichicks, you know, the relevant juggernauts that are around that we all hear about, to folks that we may not all know their stories. You know, and down there, or up there in Wisconsin, I should say, you all know the Alvarez story. Not everyone else does. I mean, he was a remarkable coach, you know, at Wisconsin and really put that team on the map. And I think he won like 120 games or so when he was there. And he won 3 Big Ten titles. I mean, not everyone, you know, there's these pockets of the world where they know the stories because they're part of the community. But when you start to go to the West Coast, not everyone knows Barry Alvarez's story. But he was, I mean, a remarkable coach. And so I find it that it's so cool to kind of pick these coaches out of their, you know, their backyards and kind of put them on a national spotlight where people can really learn a lot about all the coaches out there.
Absolutely. And speaking of Wisconsin, for instance, I'm glad that Barry Alvarez is there alongside, of course, Vince Lombardi, who would be an example of someone who's really has a national profile and for very good reason. But yes, I really appreciate that your book is a really wonderful mix of coaches. And your preface really helps us understand just how complicated it was for you to select exactly who should be there. And one of the things you've done, for instance, is to look beyond the sports that you yourself personally care about. I mean, you wanted to look beyond your own, in a sense, personal confines. And for instance, you have a couple of different coaches from my favorite sport, which is figure skating. And you tell us quite frankly and honestly that that's a sport that you, on kind of a personal level, don't know anything about or care much about. And yet, in this cavalcade of great coaches, that's a world that deserved to be represented.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what was interesting to me is that you know, at some point in time I went down these rabbit holes of coaches that I knew nothing about. I mean, I've occasionally seen figure skating on television. It's not something that I'm immediately drawn to, but what I was drawn to, without a shadow of a doubt, is the excellence in the sport. And for every sport that is out there, I mean, there are, you know, kind of the Mount Rushmore of coaches. And so you just have to find them. And they're oftentimes quite obvious as to who they are. And so that, to me, was as much fun as it was to learn about Vince Lombardi's, you know, kind of origin story, which a lot of people don't know. I mean, you know, you hear what he did as a coach for the Packers. I mean, we all know that. But when you start looking at, you know, where he came from, the fact that he was a, you know, he was an assistant first and coached high school ball and then kind of moved, you know, through Fordham and United States Military Academy and coached for the Giants. I mean, I would go as far as to say that most people didn't know that Lombardi coached for the Giants. Maybe, you know, y'all up in Wisconsin do, but I didn't. And so the beauty of it is, yes, you get these figure skating coaches that not people, that many people don't know anything about, but are clearly the best of the best. And deserve their place in sport. But then you also have these coaches that you think you know everything about, but you start to learn about where they came from, the coaching trees, who gave them their first, you know, opportunity. And that's kind of what the cool part about the known entities are. That's what I really enjoyed as well.
Right, clearly. One thing you talk about in terms of sort of determining true greatness, because really every coach that's represented in this book is a great coach who achieved great results. I mean, when you just look at the statistics, the numbers, there is greatness to be found in those numbers. And you say stats were an indispensable starting place and prerequisite, but then you said you wanted to look beneath, behind, and beyond the numbers. Tell us a little more about the way in which plain old stats were important and yet in some respects not too important in the way that you crafted this book or what you chose to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, look, to be amongst the greatest coaches in sports, it would be hard to, you know, to make the argument that this coach who has, you know, who has a losing record, who has not won a championship, who hasn't accomplished a lot from just a pure statistical perspective, should be amongst the greatest coaches in sports. It's a hard argument. But once you start looking at the statistics, what you realize is there's a lot of good coaches out there that won a lot of games. And so all that I'm saying is that's not the only qualifier to make you a great coach. There's probably a lot of coaches that I didn't include that have the statistics to be considered, you know, really remarkable. You know, a great example of this is Bobby Knight. Bobby Knight, for all intent purposes, you know, accomplished a lot as a head coach. But there was also a lot of negativity surrounding his career. Some of it self-inflicted, fair to say. Other parts of it, just his coaching style. So then you start to have to look at, well, what made him so great? What was so special about him? It certainly wasn't his, you know, his humanity, right? His gentleness with his athletes, that wasn't it. You know, so then you start looking at other qualifiers. Well, maybe it was the ability to push these men past the point that they could ever take themselves. And so he was an elevator of talent, accountability, you know, resilience. I mean, the guy had no quit. And so you're right in the sense that it's not all about the stats. The stats are, it kind of gets you a ticket to the game, for lack of a better metaphor. But once you get that ticket, there's still other qualifiers, whether it's how they shaped the game, how they changed the game, the lessons they imparted on their players, that start to dictate who are the best of the best.
Hmm. One other thing about just sort of the overall framework of the book that I want to ask you about is that you have separated the book and, in a sense, separated these coaches into four different categories: the team builders, the technicians, the strategists, and finally, the closers. And it's not to say, and you are careful to say in the preface, that it's not that Coach X is only a team builder and Coach Y is only a strategist. I mean, that there is some blurring of those lines. But clearly you saw some value in thinking about these coaches at least somewhat within this framework of four different kinds of specialists. Why was that important to you? Why do you want us to remember these four kind of categories or elements of the coaching profession when we look at these coaches and their successes?
Yeah, great question. I think fundamentally, people like things to be broken down. I mean, I think, you know, categorization and kind of putting things in buckets help us learn, just as human beings. And so part of what was fun to me is to try to challenge myself to figure out not just like who are the greatest coaches, but what made them so special. And part of what made them so special was acknowledging what their greatest strengths were. What will they be remembered as? And so that to me was kind of the extra yard, I should say. It was saying, now that I have all these coaches and they met certain criteria, if you were to say, what do we remember the most about Bill Belichick? Well, I mean, there's probably a few things, right? I mean, he won a bunch of Super Bowls, won a bunch of football games. He was Tom Brady's coach. But one of my favorite things, one of the most interesting things about him was the reason why he was so successful is he would always find the other team's greatest strength and take it away. That's remarkable strategy. And that, to me, is what has made him as special as anyone. And then you think about, you know, other coaches out there, you know, like Jimmy V, who I did a book about. What was he known for? Man, he was a closer. I mean, when they won the title, you know, the Cardiac Kids, you know, they won every one of those games by 2 or 3 points, including the national title. And so what he is known for is closing out games. And so to me, it was in some ways this added challenge that there were times when I regretted it because it wasn't always easy, but to try to really figure out not just who are the best coaches in the world, but what, you know, where do you put them in the categories of excellence? And so I came up with, you know, what I thought were really the most important styles of coaching, or qualities of coaching, and then tried to classify them accordingly. And the other part is, I think it opens up a lot of fun debate. I think that people could argue that, you know, maybe, you know, Gino Auriemma from UConn is not the greatest team builder, which I think he's a great team builder, but he's a closer because the guy just wins titles, right? So it kind of gave this additional piece of depth to the book that I enjoy.
We're speaking with Justin Spiesman about his newest book, which is called Coach, The Greatest Teachers in Sports and Their Lessons for Us All. So there's something like 170, 175 different coaches who are profiled in this book, and it's a really remarkable array. And they touch on just about every sport that there is, and it's not just present day coaches, but some important coaches from the past. My eyes lit up actually when I came across what will be one of the more obscure names in the book, because this is somebody I had the honor of interviewing on this program some years ago, namely Joe Newton, who is not from that far away, to the south of us in Illinois, perhaps America's greatest cross-country coach of all time.
Yeah.
Particularly at the high school level, at York High School, where he built just the most extraordinary dynasty. And I interviewed Coach Newton because of the a documentary film that was made about him. And I got to interview him right before that documentary was publicly screened for the first time. And I expected to be talking to the documentarian. And then, as it turns out, no, you get to talk to the coach himself. And it was a tremendous honor. But I am so glad that he is here because, of course, he and other high school coaches in your book represent a whole world that deserves more recognition in terms of the tremendous difference that is made in the lives of countless young people by amazing, dedicated coaches like Joe Newton.
You couldn't be more accurate in your assessment. I mean, Joe Newton is a perfect example of a coach that I knew very little about. But when you look at him and what he accomplished, 60 years of coaching, 28 Illinois State cross country titles. And then the documentary about his life, Long Green Line. And this gentleman reinvented running. I mean, he put running on the map. And specifically marathon running. And so he is such a remarkable example of someone that impacted sports, his sport specifically, in an almost incomparable way. That was kind of the cool part, right? Like, you get some coaches in here, the football coaches. There's a lot of people that have kind of been there, done that as well, right? Outside of a few coaches. I mean, you take a coach like Bill Cowher. I mean, he's a wonderful coach, but there's a lot of coaches that have similar resumes, right? When you look at a Joe Newton, there's no one that has that resume. That's what made it so cool, is that they stand alone at the top of their sports. And part of it is because these sports aren't as nearly as, I would just say, popular from just a pure attention perspective as football or basketball. But it would be hard to argue that there's any coach that has done more for marathon running and maybe even track and field than Joe Newton. Mm-hmm. I think it's just an easy decision. And so that's what made it really interesting to me, is that you really, when you start to get to the track and field, the figure skating, the rugby, there's oftentimes one coach that stands above them all.
Mm. And I also want to say that, I think Joe Newton is an especially good example of something that you say about coaches, certainly in team sports, where coaching is a lot like managing a business, and the parallels are really compelling, and Joe Newton's story of how he ran his cross-country team and track and field team all those years and achieved such excellence is a really great example of that. On the other hand, some of the coaches in this book are not team coaches at all, but more one-on-one coaches, which is a very different enterprise. I think it would be most timely if we spoke for a couple minutes about Tony Nadal. Of course, this is right on the heels of Rafael Nadal achieving that remarkable 21st Grand Slam title by winning the Australian Open in such spectacular fashion. And of course, fans of Rafael Nadal, one of the greatest tennis players in history, will already know, but other people might not know, that his own uncle, Antonio Nadal, was instrumental in him taking up the sport and in achieving the greatness that he has. What did you enjoy most about learning about Tony Nadal?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the family dynamic and the relationship was really, really remarkable. I mean, Tony is a record holder for the most Grand Slam titles won as a coach with 16, which was eventually broken when Djokovic's coach, Marin Vazda, won their 17th. And now, Nadal is not necessarily coaching Rafael directly. I think he stopped in 2017 or so. But Rafael just, obviously won his I believe it, his 17th. It could be one more. But so what is really unique is this, is that you have this, this family member that really is the reason why that, Nadal was playing tennis. And he also held, Nadal to a tremendous, reputation as an athlete. I mean, there's stories where he talked about if Nadal ever slammed his racket, Tony would not coach him. And so he built not just, one of the greatest tennis players in the history of tennis, but also a remarkable man as well. And so you start to get into this story of the relationship between, Tony and his nephew, and you learn a lot about this upbringing and how Tony kind of was the impetus for Rafi to start playing tennis. And then he ushered him, from the early 90s, for throughout his entire year. I mean, he was his coach for, I think, almost, 30 years. And so there's stories about how he wouldn't accept payment from his nephew. And the joke was why. The reason why he did that is because he didn't want to ever be able to be fired. And so, I mean, there's the stories are just remarkable. But, I mean, look, not to comment on the tennis player, but, you know, Nadal, many have said, have always kind of done it the right way. You know, I mean, Djokovic obviously has some conflict, and even in recent months he's had conflict. But Nadal has always been a pretty clean guy and very beloved. I mean, in the most recent, you know, Australian Open, I mean, everyone was cheering for him. They want him to win. They love him. And so you find that that all comes from a mentor like Tony. And so it was just really wonderful to learn about that relationship.
I really appreciate so much that your book has to offer, including this line that jumped out at me because I'm much more of a music person than a sports person. But you write, like music, the language of sports is universal. And of course, because of that, a lot of the lessons here are universal kinds of lessons. I want to close with just something from Chuck Knoll, the longtime coach of my second favorite football team, the Pittsburgh Steelers, who says in his chapter, "It's not my job to motivate players. If they need me to motivate them, maybe they shouldn't be here." And I like that because it reminds us that there's a lot of different ways to approach the task of coaching. And they are represented in an amazing array of possibilities here in your book called Coach, The Greatest Teachers in Sports and Their Lessons for Us All, published by Half Full and the author Justin Spiesman. Justin Spiesman, thank you so much for this great book and for the chance to talk with you about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm sad to say that I went to the Morning Show archives in search of my conversation with legendary cross-country coach Joe Newton mentioned in the previous interview, and I could not find it. If it comes to light, I will share it another time. Instead, we turn to a memorable conversation I had with sports writer L. John Wertheim several years ago, talking about his book that is one of the best books about tennis I have ever read, and recently the inspiration for a fine documentary film titled Strokes of Genius, Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played, which is in large part a chronicle of the extraordinary battle waged between Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal in the 2008 Wimbledon men's singles final. Here is a portion of that conversation in which L. John Wertheim talks about Rafael Nadal's Uncle Tony. Let's talk about each of these players and just a few of the observations which you make about them. I think you make a very interesting observation. I think actually you might be quoting someone else in saying that Roger Federer, who is Swiss, plays tennis that is quintessentially Swiss. That was somebody else's observation, but do you care to explain how Roger Federer is, as a player, quintessentially Swiss?
Yeah, you know, you sort of to lapse into stereotype, but you sort of think about Swiss characteristics, and there's the sort of precision and this punctuality. You think of a Swiss watch and all the gears going in order, and the real, I mean, I guess precision is the word I always come back to. You think about sort of a certain neutrality, a certain diplomacy, all the characteristics that, you know, the guy on the street would associate with Switzerland sure applies awfully well to Federer's personality and his tennis.
I was really struck by this observation. You said, to his parents' frustration, Federer was an indifferent, restless student in school, not dim, but not particularly dedicated. Tennis, however, fed something in him and commanded his full attention. I think that is the way it plays out with a whole lot of people, that you achieve greatness in the thing that you most love to do. But I especially love that idea about tennis for Roger Federer being something that commanded his full attention. In the end, that's probably what all of us need to find, is that thing that draws us to it in the way that tennis drew Roger Federer.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other interesting thing is that for all the, you know, the quote-unquote tennis parents, for all these sort of hardcore sports parents that are arranging for extra batting practice and hiring nutritionists and pushing their kids. The Federers were the opposite. I mean, this is sort of a well-educated, middle-class family, and, you know, they wanted him to be a better student, and if he's happen to like tennis, well, fine, you can ride your bike to the club after school, but, you know, we ain't pulling you out of class so you can hit a ball across the net. And it ended up that sort of, in a weird way, that hands-off approach probably motivated him more than anything. And, yeah, I mean, I think one of his friends sort of joked, if this had been 10 years later, he would have had a, you know, ADHD diagnosis, that he was, you know, not a dumb guy by any stretch, but just one of those kids in school that's restless, had a hard time sitting still. And the tennis court, he could get out there and obviously had some of the hand-eye coordination and some of the natural talent, but also just sort of being there and running around. And he was part of a tennis team, but there weren't, you know, they're obviously not teammates, so you sort of have collegiality and the camaraderie without depending on someone to pass you the ball or play defense. And tennis, you know, tennis just sort of clicked for him. And you hear him talk about his love of the game, and it's clear, as you said, this was sort of he feels like he's found the one thing in life he was cut out to do. And obviously, you know, we should all be so lucky.
Yeah, I like how you said at one point that his parents were not pushy. If anything, they were pulley. If they nudged him at all, it was to stop taking tennis so seriously. But of course, tennis itself seemed to have another idea. A couple other observations about Roger Federer, which I really appreciated as I reread your book. One thing you said is that the first title, major title, which Roger Federer won, his first title at Wimbledon, and was that back in 2003, I think? You said that, in a sense, this first title had a catalytic effect, as if a spigot had been tapped. Tell us what happened once Roger Federer had won this first major title at Wimbledon. What did that seem to do for him?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because people seem to forget now that there were about, you know, it sort of reminds me of Michael Jordan in the beginning and certainly LeBron James now, where there were a few years there, not obviously LeBron James in 7 years, but there were a few years when it was sort of like, okay, this Federer guy's talented and everybody's talking about what he does on the practice court, but, you know, time to put up or shut up. But there'd been a lot of disappointing results, and he was just sort of been known as the guy who had a lot of talent, and was he ever going to do anything with it? And then he had a terrible loss in the first round of the French Open that year in 2003, and people were really giving up on him and saying this guy's just a talented head case. And then 4 weeks later, he goes and wins Wimbledon, and it was just sort of, you know, some players reach the top, especially in tennis, and they just sort of say, great, I've achieved it, and now everything else is gravy, and they have a hard time sustaining it. And he sort of had the opposite reaction, which is, I've got to the top of the mountain, now I know what I have to do to get here, and, you know, I'm going to stay here for a while. So once he, you know, this was his first Grand Slam final in 2003, he wins that match, and then it was just lights out. I mean, then that started this era we're in now that, you know, 7 years later is made him the best player ever.
It's just interesting to think about how that worked for him, because one also thinks about certain players who win one major singles title and then, for whatever reason, don't quite manage to follow it up. I mean, a Michael Chang with one and only one French Open title, or Andy Roddick, or let's see, has he won more than one U.S. Open title?
One U.S. Open.
Yeah. Exactly. So it is. It doesn't always work this way, but it sure worked for Roger Federer.
Right. I mean, the other thing, too, that we see is players sort of yo-yo up and down. I mean, Andre Agassi was, you know, obviously sort of the prime example of that. But other players, too, they're up, they're down. You know, the Williams sisters, they have some injuries. I mean, Serena at one point, you know, was way outside the top 50. You know, Roger Federer has been either number one or number two for 6.5-7 years now. So apart from winning consistently, he also stayed up there in the rankings and didn't have one of these sort of dips and yo-yo careers that we also see a lot of.
You tell us that as Federer achieved greatness, one of the things that is most striking about him is that his entourage is, in your words, strikingly bare. I mean, he certainly has the means to be thickly insulated by an entourage that would sort of keep the world away. In fact, Federer does not operate that way.
Yeah, you know, as far as I'm concerned, yet another reason to like the guy, that he sort of said, look, I get to the top with just a few people around me, and it'll stay that way. He finally got an agent. He kind of sort of has a coach. His wife travels with him, but she also does administrative work. And, you know, that's really about it. There are a lot of players who aren't ranked nearly as high, who have a lot more people around him. And I think, you know, I mean, I think it says a lot about who he is and what motivates him. But I also think that there's a real element of sort of self-sufficiency. I mean, he likes finding out solutions for himself. He likes sort of figuring out everything from, you know, tactics to stringing. I think he doesn't want to be reliant on anyone else. And, you know, again, it's another reason, as far as I'm concerned, it's another reason to be fond of the guy. That, as you say, you're right. I mean, here's a guy who makes tens of millions of dollars. He could have the personal, he could have the personal chef and, you know, the personal masseuse and the whole team traveling with him as other players do. And he just sort of wants to keep it simple. And I think his attitude too, and I think this goes for a lot of things with him, is just, why mess with success? You know, this arrangement's done well for me. This racket's done well for me. Why do I need to tinker just because I might have the money or the opportunity to do so?
Rafael Nadal, you say, is often described as freakish, his genius in tennis described as freakish and fluky in a raised by wolves kind of way. And the fact that when one thinks about Rafael Nadal, very seldom do you say, oh, he reminds me of player X. I mean, he is very much a sort of a one-of-a-kind player. And yet you tell us Nadal's game is the opposite of alien. It's homemade and meticulously handcrafted. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, I mean, again, we sort of think about the tennis player, and you think about driven parents, and at a young age, the kid goes off to some academy and drops out of school and hits walls for, you know, 1,000 hours. And with Nadal and Federer both, they just came to this point by such an unusual way. And, you know, Federer's case, he just had this sort of middle-class upbringing in Switzerland. And in Nadal's case, you know, he comes from this small Spanish island. He comes from Mallorca. There really hadn't been, you know, hadn't been a big tennis history there. He has an uncle who certainly knows tennis but wasn't a pro or anything like that. Convert him from a righty to a lefty, which turned out to be a genius. And then sort of taught him these strokes. I mean, nobody hits the ball like Nadal has. And nobody is in, you know, right now, nobody's emulating him. It's a very unique way he plays tennis. And it's one of these things where you could scratch your head. You could say, hey, you've got a kid this talented. You should put him in an academy. But the family sort of did it their own way. And again, you can't really argue with the results. But both Federer and Nadal cut a very different figure from what we're used to in tennis. I mean, there's sort of, I mean, and the Williams sisters too, for that matter. So if the top four players all came to their success so differently than sort of the conventional way, maybe the lesson from this is the conventional way needs to be reconsidered.
I especially appreciated the rules that were laid down by Rafael Nadal's uncle Tony, three in particular. And in some respects, the first says so much about this family. Uncle Tony's first rule for his nephew: if you ever throw a racket, we're finished. They're expensive, and when you throw a racket, you don't just disrespect the sport, you disrespect all the people who cannot afford equipment. That is a rule that should probably be stenciled in a lot of places where tennis is taught.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I think that says a lot, not just in terms of the decorum, but just sort of in terms of the whole philosophy. I mean, Nadal's uncle, who really, in some ways, is sort of a surrogate parent. I mean, this is the guy who coached him and traveled the world with him, and I guess a close-knit family. And I think the uncle basically, you know, he has this sort of my way or the highway mentality. And the uncle sort of, again, they don't come from traditional tennis stock. This is not a family that's sort of grown up. I mean, they're well off, but they didn't grow up with a lot of the, you know, material conveniences and status. And I think the uncle was very important to him, that no matter where this kid's career got, that he kept his values. And, you know, I've seen the guy in action too. He means business. I mean, there are times where Nadal will forget his water bottle in the locker room, and they'll go out to the practice courts, and someone will fetch it for him, and the uncle will wave the court attendant off and said, no, no, no. You know, this was Raphael's responsibility, and he blew it. He's going to go in and get it. So you see the number one player in the world running across the tennis complex to get a water bottle because his uncle doesn't want him to feel like he can depend on others to cover up his errors.
Another decision his uncle made, you tell us that he did not want tennis to come too easily to Raphael, and so he would, for instance, make his nephew practice with dead balls and on pocked courts that gave dishonest bounces. In other words, he saw value in placing before his nephew obstacles that might create momentary frustrations, but which he obviously thought would further stiffen his spine and force him to achieve even greater skill.
Yeah, I mean, the uncle had a philosophy, which I think is very smart, which is, look, on the days when everything's clicking and you're feeling great and you got a good night's sleep and the conditions are perfect, you know, anyone can go out there and play good tennis. It's the winners and losers are being determined by who can play their best tennis when everything's not going well, when there's some obstacles and some adversity you've got to figure out a way to surmount. So, you know, Nadal would have a great practice and the uncle would shrug and say, hey, it was a beautiful day and you got a good night's sleep. I expect you to be good. But what are you going to do now when I play you with these dead balls and I'm aiming for the cracks in the court, so they're going to take some funny hops? And I think that's certainly expresses itself in the way Nadal plays today.
Hmm. Most of your book, of course, is dedicated to this incredible match, blow by blow, set by set. You take us through this drama. And one of the things I think you achieve that's truly amazing is that anybody who follows tennis knows how this match is going to end. And yet somehow you've created an account of this match which reads like a thriller, or I mean like a suspense novel, even though obviously there can't be too much in the way of real suspense in terms of how this is going to turn out. Was that something you consciously tried to do?
No, I appreciate that. I mean, the map sort of packed it for itself, and just the turns and the twists that this match took were so naturally suspenseful. But no, you're right. I mean, it's like I said earlier, that nobody wants to hear in the third game Nadal hit a backhand down the line and Federer responded with a forehand. I mean, it had to be more than just sort of play-by-play. First of all, because you're right, everybody sort of knew the outcome already, but also just, it, you know, probably doesn't make for interesting reading. So I think, you know, the match itself really unfolded like a thriller. And, you know, as trite as it sounds, I do have a new respect for the phrase, you know, a shame someone had to lose. Because, you know, again, a lot of cliches there, but they both played well enough to win.
Absolutely. You take us not only through the match, but also through its immediate aftermath. And one of the things that we come away with is their graciousness, but particularly the exquisite sensitivity which Rafael Nadal, the victor, demonstrated towards his vanquished foe. And a lot of tennis players would not have been so careful about their opponent's feelings. Tell our listeners, for instance, what Rafael Nadal did in terms of giving Federer space in those few minutes once after they had both left the court.
Yeah, they had bolted from the court, and you know, it was clear that Federer was really rocked by this defeat, and Nadal's entourage was outside the locker room, and they had champagne, and someone from the club had brought them, you know, a tray of champagne glasses, and Nadal sort of shushed them and told them to be quiet, and then the Wimbledon locker room, especially for the Steves, is a fairly small enclosure. And Nadal ended up, you know, he sort of went around in his sweaty clothes because he didn't want to take a shower. He wanted to just sort of give Federer his space. And I thought between sort of telling his family to pipe down because it was too close to Federer and it would be pouring salt in his wounds, and then just sort of leaving the locker room alone and just sort of doing his business. And I mean, I think Nadal didn't change till about an hour after the match because he wanted to give Federer his space. I thought that really showed a lot.
In a sense, that makes it even less surprising when there is that extraordinary moment between these two players after the Australian Open. And I think it was the very next Australian Open where Nadal is again the victor and Roger Federer actually breaks down in tears during the trophy presentation. And the gentle, encouraging words of Rafael Nadal, I mean, if there had ever been any doubt, there shouldn't have been, but if there was any kind of doubt about what kind of a gentleman Rafael Nadal is, surely those doubts were put to rest that night of that Australian Open final.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That Federer, you know, Nadal beat Federer again. Again, it was five sets, and you got the feeling between the emotions of the match and Federer sort of realizing, boy, this kid's really got my number. Federer just lost it at the trophy presentation. I mean, just crying to the point he couldn't speak. And Nadal, you know, covered for him, sort of took the microphone and then very gracefully sort of made the best of that situation. I think the other thing that's really nice is that, you know, for both these players have had successes since that Wimbledon in 2008. Nadal won in Australia. He won the Olympic gold medal. He's number one today as we speak. And yet Federer also has had successes since then, winning the French Open. He's a defending champ at Wimbledon. So it was nice that they had this tremendous match, this great rivalry, this sort of epic Wimbledon final, and yet it didn't really, you know, spell doom for the loser. They both were able to sort of thrive since then. And you know, their rivalry still goes strong. So, I mean, I think one of the nice things about this story is Federer losing that match, he's, you know, clearly pained, clearly there's been some sort of changing of the guard, and yet it wasn't the final chapter in their story.
Eljon Wertheim is the author of Strokes of Genius, Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played. The book is in large measure a chronicle of the extraordinary battle waged between Federer and Nadal in the men's singles final back in 2008, a match which Nadal narrowly won. You should know that back in 2017, Tony Nadal decided to resign from the coaching staff of his nephew, Rafael. It was an amicable parting, and Nadal has gone on to teach tennis at the Rafael Nadal Tennis Academy and is also doing some part-time coaching on the tour. Rafael Nadal, of course, has gone on to spectacular success since, and most recently won his 21st Grand Slam title by winning the men's singles final at the Australian Open in yet another epic victory. He now holds the record for most Grand Slam singles titles by any male tennis player. Over the weekend, we have two interesting interviews that will be offered up in the podcast version of The Morning Show. Tomorrow, in honor of the start of the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics, I'm going to be replaying a conversation that I had back in 2005 with a very fine young figure skater by the name of Megan Oster, who at the time was a student at Tremper High School. And at the time of our conversation, Megan Oster had just won the bronze medal at the U.S. Figure Skating Championships in the ladies' junior division. It's a conversation about the rigorous sport of figure skating and all of the things that have to align in order to achieve great success. I thought with the Winter Olympics about to begin and with figure skating among the headline events, it would be a fun time to replay this interview. That will be on Saturday's podcast. On Sunday's podcast, a conversation from way back in 2000 or 2001 with a man by the name of Robert Hollingsworth, who at the time was manager of the Kenosha Chrysler plant. And of course, that automobile plant, such a dominant presence on the Kenosha landscape in more ways than one, That plant is now completely gone, but once upon a time, it was a beehive of extraordinary activity. We talk with Robert Hollingsworth about that Chrysler plant and his